Before we get started with today's show, remember the Jalen and Jacoby After Show podcast continues this Sunday following 30 for 30's Be Water, a documentary about Bruce Lee. In 1971, after being rejected by Hollywood, Bruce Lee returned to his parents' homeland of Hong Kong to complete four iconic films. Charting his struggles between two worlds, the portrait explores questions of identity and representation through the use of rare archival interviews with loved ones and Bruce's own writings. And a reminder that all 30 for 30 documentaries can be streamed on ESPN Plus. You can download and subscribe to the Jalen Jacoby After Show now, as well as download and subscribe to The Right Time on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk to Carl Douglas. You may remember him. He worked with Johnny Cochran on the O.J. Simpson trial. He was in the O.J. Made in America documentary. He called us up and wanted to come on to talk about what's going on in the streets, so we'll talk to him. But first, all right, so I don't know if you guys been watching the news, man. It's a little wild outside. People are a little bit tense. They got a lot going on in their lives right now. It's just a lot that's happening. And in these times, Drew Brees did an interview with Yahoo Finance. I don't know what the interview was about. And to be honest, and Gabe, I mean, I ain't gonna pretend like I've really looked. I haven't seen a clip of the whole damn interview. I just know that at some point in the interview, and by the way, Yahoo Finance don't care if I watch the whole interview either, because they the ones that cut up this clip and put it on the internet. And all the stuff that's going on in the street, the dude from Yahoo Finance, I think his name was Daniel Roberts, he decided he wanted to ask Drew Brees a question, right? Because, you know, the stuff, the police brutality and the likes reminded him of Kaepernick and the protest and the national anthem. And he just asked Drew Brees, you know, what he thought about the protest for the national anthem, or what he think, you know, if they came back around. And Drew Brees gave what I think is the answer that he probably has given all the time about these matters.
Well, I will never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America or our country. Let me just tell you what I see or what I feel when the national anthem is played, and when I look at the flag of the United States, I envision my two grandfathers who fought for this country during World War II, one in the Army and one in the Marine Corps, both risking their lives to protect our country and to try to make our country and this world a better place. So every time I stand with my hand over my heart, looking at that flag and singing the national anthem, that's what I think about. And in many cases, it brings me to tears, thinking about all that has been sacrificed, not just those in the military, but for that matter, those throughout the civil rights movements of the 60s and everyone and all that has been endured by so many people up until this point. And is everything right with our country right now? No, it's not. We still have a long way to go. But I think what you do by standing there and showing respect to the flag with your hand over your heart is it shows unity. It shows that we are all in this together, we can all do better, and that we are all part of the solution.
That is the dumbest I have ever heard. Do you realize how far your head has to be up your own keister to say that when you see the flag and you hear the national anthem, you think about the civil rights protesters? Gabe, you heard that?
Yeah, I heard that. There's like a natural follow-up there, is there not? We can do better. Oh,
what can we do better about? Like, that's the thing. That's the dismissal. That's the same thing that your boy Dabo does. The whole thing is like, are things bad here? Yeah, they could be better. And then just right, roll off into something else here. And so with Brees, who seems to have figured out that he really, 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 really messed up, right? Like he seems to get that he absolutely 100% blew this, and now he's trying to fix it. He's got an Instagram post. I think the Saints at the time of this recording are having a Zoom meeting. Gave time for the players only Zoom, right? Like we're already at this place and everything he did. And I'm gonna give you a little time to get this. Can we get Ed Reed right fast? Check my timeline for the Ed Reed. What happened to Drew Brees here? It's one thing that he said it. The whole league turned on him. I ain't never seen nothing like this. Like, I want you to think about something. We talk all the time about how don't nobody ever actually get canceled. And these cats is trying to get Drew Brees all the way up out the paint. Malcolm Jenkins, who used to play for the Saints and now plays for the Saints again, got on the internet and made a video that ended and told Drew, and I quote, "You need to shut the f*** up." Like, that is what Malcolm Jenkins told him. Then Malcolm Jenkins went on CNN right after. Have you ever heard of a situation where somebody felt comfortable telling the Hall of Fame quarterback that quarterback's his team to shut the f*** up? Like, in the hierarchy and the understanding of the way that the NFL works. Like, Malcolm's had enough. And I get it, too. Malcolm been out here. Malcolm probably catching it on one side from white folks who don't want to hear him talking about, like, all the stuff about the police and everything else. But then he's catching it on the other side from black folks who think he's some kind of Uncle Tom because he's, like, the not Colin Kaepernick dude. Can you imagine how tired and stressed out and sick of all of this Malcolm Jenkins is? And then he got to come out here and Drew Brees out here talking the noise that he was talking on that. You said something else in that was ridiculous. Like, the grandfather stuff, I've already talked about that. Your grandfather served and came back. Our grandfather served, came back. Some of them got killed. Some of them still had to live under Jim Crow. All of this stuff. Like, flagrantly disrespected in their uniforms, coming back after they fought in wars where they didn't even have full citizenship of the country they were representing at the time. How do you still not get where people are coming from in this? And more importantly, when this question is being asked, this question is being asked of Drew Brees relative to what's going on right now, right? This was a question that was spurred by what is happening to people, by what people are seeing on the news, right? By what people are being asked to endure right now. You know that's why the question is asked. The question comes to you and all you talk about is yourself. That is the thing about Drew in there where he's like, yo, I need to learn. I need to understand more. Even if you understand more, it's not going to change the reality that when this question came out, all you thought about was you at a time where even your fellow white folks are thinking about other people. Do you realize how far the tide has to turn in a situation for white people to be like, hold on, we think about other people right now, baby. This ain't even about us. That ain't never happened as far as I can recall. One time in my life. But that was the move that he made. And now he's got to get right with his teammates. We'll see, right? Like, however it winds up going, maybe he winds up getting it right. I don't know. But I feel like what probably happened the moment that he realized, oh man, I got a problem. Ed Reed, I don't know if he's from New Orleans exactly, but he's from around there. Like, he might be from La Place or something in the neighborhood, but he is from, you know, he's from down there. Ed Reed, who I've learned apparently spends all day long on Instagram Live. Like, this is just what he does. And while he was on Instagram Live, here's some of what he had to say about Drew Brees.
I'm going to just get straight to it. I see Drew Brees trying to do his part in keeping black folk down. You're a straight sucker for that, Drew Brees. We all got kids, so I'm going to try to mind what I say right now. Drew Brees, you're a straight sucker, man. You're a sucker for that, bro. Why you think all these young people out here protesting? Why you think they out here protesting? The looting, I can see you speaking on the looting and saying that's bad, you don't support that. But why you think all these young people out here protesting?
I really ain't got no more words for you, bro.
Yes, you do.
You're a sucker, man. Straight BS, man. Straight BS. And for all my Saints fans, for all my New Orleans people who still like your ass just because they want to win games... Y'all right with him. You understand? Drew Brees, you're a sucker. You're going to be a sucker. You understand? Punk, man.
Ed Reed has had enough. And Ed Reed is one of the few people that everybody likes. Do you know anybody who doesn't like Ed Reed? Have you ever heard anybody say, man, I hate Ed Reed?
No, man. I don't know many Pittsburgh Steelers fans, so.
But I don't even hear from them, right? Like, everybody likes Ed Reed. Ed Reed got the last speeches here at the Hall of Fame. Because everybody likes Ed Reed. And Ed Reed made this turn here on Drew Brees. And I tell you, my thought on this with Drew is that has always been the right answer for Drew Brees. Like, that kind of answer has made Drew Brees wealthy. You see what I'm saying? Like that's what's made him who he is. And so he just hit that button and he rattled off everything that there was for him to say when these matters come down and everything else. He just spun it out. He was like, cool. Da, 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 like, robotic quarterback answer. Everybody go, love this. Watch, watch, watch. And then people watched and they were like, what? Like, LeBron came for him? You saw that? But LeBron brought the noise to him? He caught it in every direction. But this is the big one, and this is the one I want people to think of, because, I mean, I do kind of find it hilarious the way that this is all shaken out. But I think that this is important. From the outside, we have made Drew Brees the hero of the rebuilding of New Orleans, right? Like, he arrives in 2006, the Storms in 2005, the Saints come back in 2006. He and Reggie Bush are kind of the faces of, like, the resurrection of the New Orleans Saints. I mean, they were never good before, but we call it a resurrection. Anyway, like, that's what he is, though. That's the person. Remember that year they went to the NFC Championship game that first year there. And so we have made him the face of all these things, and he's done a lot of really, really good work in New Orleans. But my guy David Dennis wrote a great column that was entitled Drew Brees Doesn't Care About Black People, right? Also, great headline. But his point, and I think this is very important, I'm going to read you some passages explicitly from this. He says, he was down with Drew until Drew said what he had to say about Colin Kaepernick in 2016. And this is the reason why Dennis had a problem with this. He says, quote, Drew Brees owes so much of his legacy to the tragedy that was Katrina. Brees came to New Orleans in the wake of the storm, and the way he catapulted the Saints to the playoffs and the eventual Super Bowl win in 2010 made him part of the story of the city's rebuilding. And it is important here to note that Brees and his family have donated millions to the city beyond the revenue he brought as a singly talented quarterback. However, his mythology is directly attached to a disaster that is a reflection of the racial inequalities black folks face in this country. And there's another level to this, and I don't think David said this as explicitly in the column, but this is important. People in New Orleans felt betrayed by the federal government. Like, they specifically felt betrayed by the American flag, right? Keeping in mind that, you know, you had the reports that were coming out at the time in the aftermath of the storm of people trying to get out of New Orleans and go to neighboring towns and being shot by the cops on bridges as they tried to get over, right? Like, the people in that city, white, black, and otherwise, largely hold this against the United States. Like, as the government is an entity, but still against the United States. Like, the relationship that they have with the country is a bit fraught for what I think we would term here to be understandable reasons. But this is the line that David Dennis closes this with. And I mean, this is how you write a column, man. He comes at the end and he says, Drew Brees can pretend all he wants that it is about the flag or his grandfather's or whatever excuse he wants. This is about something else entirely. This is about another white man silencing black people because they make him uncomfortable. This is anti-black. This is why players are kneeling. If Drew Brees refuses to make way for solutions, then he is standing in the way of equality. I don't care how much he convinces himself otherwise. Now, you ready? You ready? Here he goes. If Drew Brees wants to be the hero he thinks he is, he needs to disentangle himself from his love of preserving white ideals and truly stand with black people. Until then, he's just an anti-black football star in a city he's betrayed. That's where the mic drops. But the thing is, you got an argument he did betray that city, man. That city's full of poor, struggling black people living. The worst in New Orleans is worse than any place that you're going to go in this country. Like, a lot of you, if you go to the worst in New Orleans, you'll be surprised that this is America. Right. The levels of poverty and everything else that's going on there. It's horrible, terrible, bad news in so many ways. Like, we go down there, we hang on Bourbon Street, we go drinking, you know, drinking, dance and all this stuff, man. That ain't necessarily what the life is for everybody else. I always say about New Orleans, it would be awful if it wasn't so awesome. It would be awesome if it wasn't so awful. It all depends on what your perspective is on this one. But the truth is, as much as y'all like about, like, Kaepernick and, like, oh, the fans and the people, what are they going to say about him? That city is blackety black, black, black. Right. It may not be the majority of who's in that dome, but it's a lot of who's in that dome and who's around that dome and who's around that city. And those are the people that had to rebuild themselves and that you give Drew Brees all the credit for. And whether he knew it or not, he just spit in their faces. And whether he realized it was going to be the case with his locker room, he just spit in their faces. And it's going to take more than an Instagram post or a Zoom meeting in order for him to fix that. And you might not be offended by what went down here. But it don't matter whether or not you offended. Because, like, with Kaepernick, I want to make this point about Kaepernick. My biggest disagreement with people on Kaepernick is when they made the argument that, well, we're not going to be able to make, you know, we're not going to make any money with Kaepernick here. I was like, y'all ain't going to lose a dime. People still going to show up. I ain't never seen no evidence that anybody was going to turn their backs on this in the name of Colin Kaepernick. I have seen evidence that a football team might turn its back on its Hall of Fame quarterback behind this. Right? Like this is a thing. I don't know how exactly they go about fixing it all. I don't know how they go about correcting it all. But just so you know, Drew Brees did a serious damage to his legacy in the way that really truly matters with football players. Not so much about the money, but about that team that you idealize so much. They looking at him funny, just like a lot of us are looking at him funny.
How much of this do you think is affected by the fact that the NFL is not playing games right now? And it's the off season, because we talked about before about how college football coaches wanted to kind of keep their players on campus, you know, in line with COVID so that they can kind of control the narrative and keep everyone together, keep everyone safe, mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff. At least when it's in season or at least in preseason, everybody's together just in terms of like a geographic location, everybody's together. Whereas right now, Brees is on his own, right? He's in New Orleans or wherever he is. He's by himself. He's not surrounded by the other players, but everybody's together in the sense that they're all online because of the news, right? So everybody's following the news day in and day out. Everybody's online all together, but they're not in the same geographic location. How much of that do you think changes what's going on right now?
I think it's better for him that they're not in the same location, because if he's in the same sort of location, somebody would run up on him the second he walked in the door. I think at the very least, cats get to cool down, and that's the thing that helps him.
But do you think that that emboldened what he said, maybe?
Oh, I got you. No, I think that he's oblivious enough, would not have realized that was a problem even if them dudes were there every day. You know, I think that he believes I'm Drew Brees and I get to say what this thing is. And then he just said it. And I mean, good luck with this dog. I just don't think my bad is going to work. Because look, when's outside going to calm down? Because that's his biggest issue. Like, let's be honest about this. This doesn't go over the way it did if he said it a month ago. This doesn't go over the way that he did if he said it 2 months ago. I don't even know if this goes over the way it did if he said it 2 weeks ago, right? But when outside going to calm down? You think it's coincidental, by the way, that what was going on with Kaepernick happened in the election year of 2016? Right? And we're back in one of these election years? So when does this calm down? When do the other things that inform the ways that people feel about this with Drew Brees, when does that chill out? I don't see that chilling out anytime soon. Like, this is an observation I want to make about outside right quick. Often in these cases, what brings people inside is like charges against the officer, whether they're made or whether the announcement is made that they're not going to be charges, right? But there tends to be like some inflection point, like people are outside, like what has you outside? We outside because we want to see charges brought. Like in St. Louis or Ferguson, when that was going down, it was largely about we want to see charges brought against this cop that shot Mike Brown, right? And then once that got resolved, everything else kind of resolved itself and it kind of calmed down. They don't charge these dudes in Minnesota. They already got the first one. They've gotten to the next three. Dude, ain't nobody worried about that. That's not what's going to bring people back inside. And so I don't know how long people are going to be outside. I don't know what it's going to be the necessitating factor that's going to make all that stuff calm down. But I see no end in sight there. And if there's no end in sight to what's going on outside, there's not going to be really a path to forgiveness for Drew Brees unless he's going to jump on board the way that these guys are jumping on board. But Drew Brees ain't going to jump on board for that, because Drew Brees sells endorsements for companies who have not put out statements in these times. And I'm not judging these companies for not putting out these statements, because, hey, if they don't mean it, they don't mean it. And I don't believe there's a value in a hollow statement. Wrangler ain't putting out no statements right now. Advocare ain't putting out no statement right now. Drew Brees' money is in saying things like he said. Like, that's the thing about this. He said the money answer. He said the answer that's made him a hero. He said the answer that's made him famous. And then suddenly in one day, that answer don't count no more. That answer's not the one that people want to hear, but he can't turn around to this other answer because there ain't no money in that one for him either. Like, you think if Drew Brees got out here and was like the champion of the Black Lives Matter movement, that he's still going to be out here doing these Wrangler commercials? No, because that's not who Wrangler is selling to. That's not what they about. Same thing with Advocare. That's not what they're about. So he thought he was given the safe, all-American answer. I don't know how he turns this back around while staying consistently true to himself, right? Because he seemed like one of them cats, like he had to put an Instagram statement, because you can't do no interview with him, because he goes start by saying the right thing, and then eventually you let him talk too long, he's going to say what he mean. And these cats know that that was what you meant. Like, you could try to convince him that you shouldn't have said it, but you're not going to convince him that that's not what you meant. And the fact that is what he meant, that's going to be his holdup.
It's a company line. It's a company line for Advocare. It's a company line for Wrangler. And it's a company line for the NFL.
Bingo. Everything the NFL has given us has told us that what Drew Brees said is actually the company line. That is a great... Gabe, it's all chaos. It's all chaos.
There's no fear, which is a great thing to hear, right?
So what's the NFL going to do? Like, that's the thing. The NFL got to look at it itself and be like, yo, so what do we do next? All right, so Mike Norvell, I imagine a lot of you have not heard of him. Mike Norvell is now the head coach at Florida State. He was the head coach at Memphis before. And keep in mind that he made some news when he got that job, Gabe. You remember that? He was the dude that was like no hoodies and no gold chains at the facility and all of that. I had somebody tell me that they believe that all that stuff he was talking there, those are rules that like Todd Graham had at Arizona State. Like that's where he gets that. But I also think that my man who told me that, Gabe, made the same mistake you made, which was mixing up Mike Norvell with Jay Norvell. And I honestly had no idea that so many people knew who Jay Norvell was.
Well, I mean, when you have two brothers.
No, my bad. He was at Arizona State too. Sorry. He was an Arizona State guy also. So all our Norvells are like coming together, in the same space. But here's what he did. He did an interview with my buddy, Tashan Reed at The Athletic. He's now covering the Raiders for The Athletic. Check him out. He does good work. But Tashan was doing an interview with Norvell, and I want to make sure I get the exact quote here for you because it's important. Because he was talking to Norvell about, you know, stuff, right? Like, what's it like to be a college coach right now with all this stuff going on? And Mike Norvell said, and I quote, "We had a lot of open communication with our team, our players, and our coaches. I went back and forth individually with every player this weekend." Okay? That's the key. "I went back and forth individually with every player this weekend." Marvin Wilson, his best player, sent out a tweet that said, quote, and I'm going to translate some emojis here. "Man, this did not happen, man. We got a generated text that was sent to everybody. There was no one-on-one talk between us and coach. This is a lie, and me and my teammates as a whole are outraged, and we will not be working out until further notice." Yes. Yes. We will not be working out until further notice. And so now what the word is getting out is that, yeah, they sent a text to everybody, but if you replied, the coach would talk to you, which is not the same thing as what Norvell said right there. He lied. There's just no way around it. He lied. Now, Florida State, right before we're doing this recording, is supposed to have some team meeting, right? So we'll find out who did or did not go, or everything that is, you know, that's surrounding that or that's related to it. But I guess this is a lie that you could have gotten away with in the past. But, and by the way, just to be clear, it's a lie. Like, I've talked to somebody else who's given me some indication of what's going on. Even if it's not a lie, the players think it's a lie. And I'm telling you guys, man, this ain't something that'll get a dude like Norvell fired. But this is something that can make it impossible for him to do his job. Like I said on Twitter, that it's simple. If he lied, he's got to quit. And people are like, oh, and Bomani's telling him to, forcing him to resign. I'm not saying I'm forcing him to resign. What I'm saying is a lie of this magnitude on this topic in these times, you can lose your whole team right here and it becomes functionally impossible for you to do your job. That's what the concern is. Like, that's the issue that Drew Brees has over there, is functionally, can you do your job after this? Is this something that these dudes are in a position to just let slide? Right? Now, granted, Clemson had an assistant coach who called somebody the N-word, and they found a way to let that slide, right? So, like, it can be done, but Dabo had been there for a minute. Like, Dabo had built something up. This dude's just walking in the door right here. And my understanding with Marvin Wilson is Marvin Wilson could have gone in the draft, but the big reason he stayed is because he was so impressed with Mike Norvell. So the guy that was the strongest on his side, he lost. Like, he lost that dude right there on the basis of a wildly unnecessary lie.
Relationship is all about trust.
Yep. And they just fired a dude where you could easily complain about his record, but the players seem to respect him as a man. Mike, this is one thing I'm going to tell you now. If you are running a college football program, that you need to understand. If you decide to fire your black coach, you can do that, right? But if it's the black coach that develops like real relationships and trust with the players, you better make damn sure that the next guy you hire is a good man. Like, you have got to do that. We've seen this happen at Texas, where they fired Strong, and there were legitimate reasons to fire Strong, but then they hired a jerk. And there have been struggles through time with that guy, Tom Herman, trying to figure out how to relate to his players. And by the way, Gabe, have you seen Tom Herman's statements in the aftermath of all of this? Tom Herman went so far as to say, basically, yeah, you'll cheer for these guys in the stadium, but how would you feel if they tried to date your daughters? And how would you feel about them trying to date your daughters? I didn't make that part up. That's in a statement. Like, apparently, I had to ask some people about this because I'm like, yo, man, what's really going on here with Herman? And they all told me that maybe he realizes roster hates him. I don't know. But he has actually been making a real effort to inform himself about these things and to get better about this, because you can't lose your team. You know what I mean?
People are telling on themselves right now.
Yes. And Tom Herman did not. Tom Herman got out there and was like, no, I'm not going to do that. You cannot lose your team. Like, this is a real tenuous situation for a lot of these coaches. You can very easily lose your team. And if you lose your team, you cannot do the job. And if you're Florida State and it's clear early that he's lost the team, then you got to let him go. Like, you get an interim and you figure it out. You find where you're going to get the money. Like, you two on both sides try to get it together. Either you got to come out here and win a bunch of games, or you're going to lose these dudes forever. And that is, I think, what we're going to learn more than anything else. It's something we've always known, but it's going to come more to the forefront. If you lose the team, you've lost everything. All right. It is that time of week where we do our interviews. But before we get to that, I got to tie back to something where earlier we had talked about how I went on Twitter and said that Wrangler had not put out a statement. Well, what do you know? After I said on Twitter yesterday that Wrangler hadn't put out a statement, Wrangler put out a statement, and they said black in it and everything else. Drew Brees, maybe the little Nas X gave a call. I have no idea, but either way it goes, Wrangler has now put out a statement. Also, Florida State had their meeting with Mike Norvell. We'll find out how everybody feels. The reports are conflicting, but joining us now, he made a star turn with us 4 years ago. We saw him in OJ Made in America, worked with Johnny Cochran on that trial. He's a prominent attorney in Los Angeles. His name is Carl Douglas. My man, how are you?
I am blessed, brother, and highly favored indeed.
Hey, man, it is good to talk to you. I appreciated you reaching out to come on, because I think this is a great thing. It's a great time to kind of talk about these things. And one thing I wanted to start with before we get to the current situation, and I think this is kind of important historically, because as I mentioned, people saw your appearances in OJ Made in America, and Johnny Cochran, I think, in people's minds, by and large, is OJ Simpson's attorney. But I think if you were in Los Angeles, you would think of Johnny Cochran as the attorney to call in a time like this.
Absolutely so, man. He made his name, Bomani, as a 27, 28-year-old whippersnapper representing the family of a woman named Eula Love, who got shot and killed because she was complaining about a water bill. In those days, they would have something that was called a coroner's inquest. And there was the county council who would be asking the questions, inquiring into the circumstances of the death. The lawyer for the family could not ask questions then, but they could sit at council table and give questions to the county council to ask instead. In Los Angeles, that was a very visible killing. We're Hollywood, so we like televisions. So that inquest was televised for all of Black America to see. And you would hear the white older county council say, Mr. Cochran wants to know, because Mr. Cochran would be asking the shooting officers who reached inside of his car with his gun to fire a shot about certain tactics. And Mr. Cochran wants to know. And Mr. Cochran wants to know. And that set into motion in a city, man, that has had a history of strife between Black Americans and the African American community for as long as I can remember. Bruh, I was 10 years old in 1965 talking to the National Guard who were parked and stationed at a high school a half a block from my house. I was peering through the gates, amazed at these camouflage uniforms that I'd only seen on pictures, you know, in the movies. It was, and we in LA burn. It is part of the fabric of our history. But like Dr. King says, unrest is the language of the voiceless. So this time in Johnny Cochran's history, Johnny was, he was cast in that crucible of those times. And he continued to put his faith in the people in combating racism in Los Angeles. I tell people all the time, as large as Johnny Cochran became after O.J. Simpson, he was every bit that much of a hero to the black and brown people of Los Angeles before O.J. Simpson for 25 years.
And I think there's a particular thing with the LAPD that people do not quite realize is that, especially in the 1950s and 1960s, they were seeking out officers from the South. Like, they were doing job fairs in Atlanta to find officers to work in Los Angeles because they felt that those people had the proper mentality necessary to police an urban area, which is like the most ironic use of code you could possibly have.
And it is all part of the us versus them mentality, which in Los Angeles is ingrained in the very fabric of our police department. And which explained, no one, brother, could understand the O.J. Simpson verdict without understanding the dynamics between the police department and the African-American community in Los Angeles. And it's kind of ironic, man, because in the O.J. trial, we did a focus group and we saw that African-American females were the number one supporter of O.J. Simpson. The prosecution did a focus group as well. And they saw that black females were the number one supporters of O.J. Simpson. But that was contrary to Marsha Clark's thinking because of her experience. She'd always related to black women. They would write her after trials they had had. So she ignored her own advisors because she thought O.J. had white women. Black women don't like a brother with a white woman. So they're never going to feel for O.J. Simpson. What she didn't realize, my brother, is in Los Angeles, black women are the mothers and the wives and the daughters of black men. So in Los Angeles, black women know how police have had their knees on the necks of black Americans in Los Angeles for most of my lifetime. All of my lifetime, indeed.
And it's interesting, too, because I totally see why that was the bet that she made. Under a whole different set of circumstances, she was absolutely on the right track, except for the one that she needed to be on.
Exactly right, brother.
All right. So what was it about what's going on now that made you reach out?
Because talking about race is always the third rail. And I enjoy that you have a certain clarity about questions of race that are all too missing in the public conversation. I want your listeners to know several things, man. First, it is that police brutality is not getting worse. I repeat, police brutality is not getting worse. It's getting televised. I grew up with the Last Poets. Gil Scott Heron had a poem that said the revolution would not be televised. However, that was before the days of cell phones. My brother, the revolution is being televised because the cultural revolution is live. It's funny because, man, there are so many people out there that are George Floyd's that nobody knows about. Let me tell your listeners about one. March 13th of 2020, Oro Nunes Sr., that's N-U-N-I-S. Oro Nunes is a 47-year-old Jamaican-American. He stands 5'4" tall. My brother, Oro Nunes weighs 145 pounds. On the evening of March 13th, 2020, Oro Nunes, a father of seven, a husband of 22 years, a truck driver who has never been arrested for anything in his life, was visiting his daughter in Chula Vista, which is a small town in San Diego County. Mr. Nunes was suffocated by five Chula Vista police officers who were trying to detain him. Mr. Nunes had done nothing wrong. He had not even tried to pass a fake $20 bill. His daughter had called the police because Mr. Nunez needed help. Cops, my brother, in small towns aren't often trained as well as cops are in big cities. They don't get the cream of the crops in terms of police candidates. Often, they get the leftovers, to be kind. They wanted to detain Oro Nunez Sr., and those five cops were unable to detain this unarmed man who was 5'4" without killing him. I say right now, my brother, if five trained cops cannot detain a man 5'4" without killing him, they don't deserve to be police officers. Yeah, I said it. Bomani, nobody is marching for Oro Nunez Sr. And I have to explain to his wife and to one of his seven children why no one is marching for Oro Nunez Sr. Because his death was not televised. But I remain hopeful, my brother. I've been suing cops for 40 years. There are more diverse protesters now than I have seen in my lifetime. I got a case, brother, where white protesters are being beaten by the LAPD. I got a case, brother, where a white protester was shot by a bullet, a rubber bullet by the LAPD, and lost his testicle. A white protester who's a South African, who was a member of the ANC, who has pictures with him and Nelson Mandela, who in 1998 met Johnny and Dale Cochran when they were visiting South Africa. And he was so inspired that he chose to move to California and seek a new life for himself. This man, Bradley Stein, S-T-E-Y-N, had a Black Lives Matter t-shirt on May the 30th in Los Angeles to protest. He had hashtag anti-apartheid on his t-shirt that he wrote. He drove from Ventura County to come and to protest. He had never protested once in his life. He was on Fairfax near 3rd Street when the skirmish line started. He saw people starting to run, my brother. And he started to run away as well. This white man then saw a police officer striking a black woman in the bushes. And to protect her, he intervened and he kicked the officer away. A second officer then came upon him and in point blank range fired two rubber bullets down, one in his left thigh. He then turned and fired, shooting him down in his right testicle. I got a shorts, man, with a hole in the testicle that I'm saving for evidence. That is progress in a lot of ways. Because it's going to take more Bradley Steins to come forward and speak out before there'll ever be real change. I hate to say, man, there's going to be more George Floyds before there's real change. There's going to have to be more protests as well. But we, good Americans, can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can protest and vote. We can protest and be on a jury. Because, Bo, I will tell you, brother, the one thing that a cop is afraid of is a black person on a jury. Trust me when I say, my brother, when those cop lawyers or a DA sees a black person walking into the courtroom, man, you would think somebody said he has the virus. Get away, get away. Don't touch me. I tell you, because a black man on a jury has power. A black man on a jury can stop injustice. A black man on a jury can save a life. A black man on a jury can make a difference. So if I can impart anything on your listeners, it's two things. One, protest and vote. Power does not concede power. voluntarily. And two, when you get that jury summons, take it and go out to vote. Those things we can do every day because there's going to be more George Floyds. This cultural change is like an ocean liner, my brother. It ain't like a speedboat, regrettably. It took me 65 years to understand that. Think about it. It took years and decades of protest for abortion rights to come about change. It took years and years of protest for gay marriage to be a reality. And in a crusade that is near and dear to my heart, it took years and years of protest for marijuana to be legalized. So that is what's going to have to happen. On the same level, bruh, you go on IG, man, and they're shooting white women in the head with rubber bullets. I'm trying to get a white woman client with rubber bullet damage because my brother in America, man, when they start dealing with white women, you know everybody's going to take notice. Black folks was shooting heroin for decades. And then they called it opium and handed it to white women in Ohio, and there's an opium epidemic. Black people were shooting up smoking crack for decades. And then they call it cocaine, and white folks started getting arrested, and they had to change the stuff. I've been smoking weed since I was 16 years old. I used to meet my boy in the parking lot of the Jack in the Box. Now I can walk into a store and pay taxes. So change is coming, my brother. It's just gonna take a time. It's gonna take vigilance because there's a culture. The code of silence among police is the greatest impediment to justice known to man. And the George Floyd example just reflects that. Think about it. One, Chauvin wasn't even there in the beginning. He comes late from his car. You got to get in the community that you patrol to have a sense of humanity. There was no sense of humanity. Chauvin had his knee on the brother's neck, and there was the Asian cop over his shoulder who could have said, okay, guy, that's enough. We got him. We got him. We got him. But he didn't do that. He could have said, you know, Dan, they're filming. They're filming. But he didn't do that. Why? Because he was comfortable that they would get away with it. Chauvin had 18 complaints. 17 of them were unfounded. It is dangerous out there for cops, my brother. I've been on a ride along. It scared the shit out of me. And I've been suing cops for 40 years. White folks are scared of black and brown brothers. In L.A., for good reason. I get it. In California, we cannot make a police officer live in a particular area that they patrol, though it would be smart and it would be best. But because of this separation, there is the military mentality that our president reinforces, us against them, and there lacks a connection of humanity that is necessary for you to understand that this is a person whose neck you are on. Bruh, 40 years. I ain't never seen a black cop pummeling a black person. Shooting is some different boom, boom, shooting. But you ain't never heard of a black cop suffocating a black person. I ain't never heard of a white cop suffocating a white person. Because there's that shared humanity that makes them stop. It is implicit. There is no connection. So it's going to be a while for things to change, but I'm hopeful. We got police chiefs, man, taking knees. That ain't ever been seen before. We got Chief Arredondo from Minneapolis who was raised a block from where George Floyd lived, coming out of the station without no guards and just talking among the protesters. That was fabulous. We got police chiefs taking knees and marching with the protesters. It's only a few. It'll take a while, but I am hopeful that things will get better. I gotta be hopeful, man. I wish they put me out of business, please.
Well, like, I've been surprised by how much different the reaction has been to this one. And it's not like this is the first time that we've had a video, right? So, like, what do you think it is about this case?
Because this time, the victim narrated his own death. It was progressive and it was vivid. Bruh, trust me, we are in the visual age. Okay? You know, visuals are everything. I'm a storyteller, so I want visuals. In this one, the brother said, I'm down. Mama, help. I can't breathe. You're gonna kill me. I'm gonna die. He was narrating his own death. And anybody in Australia could see the pain of that. Bruh, they're marching in Australia. There's a change coming. They're marching in New Zealand. There's a change coming. They're marching with them rednecks in France. There's a change coming. But it's an ocean liner, not a speedboat.
I am just like, a lot of things you pointed to, like seeing the things that are happening, like I feel like in part why this is going to be something that can turn this is the violence is absolutely being perpetrated upon people we were not accustomed to seeing this violence. Like that's a jarring situation right there. I saw the clip of the cop and I think it was in Brooklyn who threw this white woman down on the ground. I was like, oh, that's not going to play.
Yes. Yes. That is, I'm telling you, what's going to turn the tide. Opium, bruh. Think about the opium epidemic as an example. Black folks have been shooting and dying from opium since I was a baby. You never heard about a heroin epidemic. But then they normalize it. You know, they rebrand it and they call it opium. And you got folks in Ohio shooting up opium in Ohio. And now, If there was any president in office that had an empathetic, compassionate gene in his body, they would be focused on addressing the opiate crisis. He only looks at it because Ohio's a swing state and he needs it to win. But it is a difference, regrettably, when they start killing people that look like you. That's the whole thing. That's the essence of humanity, because I love black people so much. I cried when I first saw George Floyd dying. Because I love black people so much. Because I love black people so much. When white folks who love white people more than black people, I get it, see white pain, that's when it's going to be visceral. It's going to happen because the internet makes us all more one. It's going to happen when the middle level cops retire and get older so that the culture can change. The cops in their mid 30s to late 40s to early 50s, they are the sergeants. They are the trainers. They are the one that is continuing with the culture that will not change until they retire off and die by natural causes, I say.
Now, how's Los Angeles looking right now?
Very mixed, man. One, because of the curfew, everyone is adjusting. It's not that bad because folks were adjusting because of the virus anyway. And we are a very left and compliant community. We're very much we trust our government. We understand science in California. And we don't dispute it. Virtually everyone who was protesting in California wore a mask. So we understand the risks of what we are doing and the importance of the time. But I dare say because there is such a rich history in Los Angeles. Whenever there is an incident across the country and somebody sneezes, we catch a cold here. I represent Dr. Malina Abdullah. She is the head of Black Lives Matter in Los Angeles. Dr. Abdullah is the chairman of the Pan-African American Studies Department at Cal State Los Angeles. She is a magnificent, bold, tremendously astute sister. And she keeps me on my toes and aware about the challenges that we of oppressed people in this city continue to have. Think about it, Bomani. Los Angeles had a black mayor for 20 years. He didn't want cops to beat up black people, but he did, and it happened. We had a Latin cop. He didn't want society to beat up Latin people, but they did, because the problems are beyond the power of any one person to change. And then you couple that, man, the issue is because Los Angeles is liberal, San Francisco is liberal. The rest of the state could be Iowa, South Dakota, Missouri, outside of St. Louis. You feel me?
Yeah, that actually gets lost when people talk about California. Like, I tell people, like, when's the last time you saw 48 Hours? And there's that scene in the bar with the Confederate flag on the wall. Like, that is California. Where you think those people got there from?
Bruh, you can go an hour outside L.A. You can go to Klan rally. You got to have the right hookup. In Fontana, 45 minutes. You got the Klan rally.
I've been to Fontana. Let's see. You don't know this. I went to graduate school in Claremont. And I moved out there on 2 weeks' notice. And I thought it was in L.A., right? It was like Southern California. I thought it was in L.A., incorrect, ladies and gentlemen. It was not there, and they had just smoked a brother like a year before I got there. The gun was put on him, and the gun like traced back to the dead police chief in Ontario. Like, I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I completely misunderstood where I was moving.
Brother, I went to Northwestern, but my second choice was CMC.
Oh, that'd have been an experience.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
I'm trying to imagine you at Claremont McKenna, and I cannot do it at all.
I became black in Chicago, I'll tell you that.
Man, so as we see what's happening, one question I've been curious about, and you work in this space. So like, we see a guy like Ben Crump, for example, and he's representing the family and dealing with the police department as this happens. Given that this is a criminal matter, not a civil matter, what does an attorney do for a family in a time like this?
First and foremost, the attorney should comfort the family and explain the process. Particularly in a high profile case such as what George Floyd is going to go through, there are going to be the eyes of the world on everyone and everything. It is remarkable, Bomani, that in that case, the chief of police fired the four officers within days. It is Operation Warp Speed that Attorney General Ellison brought charges within 10 days. That is remarkable. I've had cases where the passenger of a stolen car was shot and killed by mistake, and the district attorney took 3 years to issue the end of their investigation, bringing no charges against the officers for the death of the passenger of a stolen car. So the lawyer's job, though, is to comfort and explain. I typically tell my clients that no one is going to get prosecuted and no one is going to get fired. I also tell my clients that the civil justice system doesn't make it right. That money doesn't make the pain go away. So they have to learn to heal with time and the process. Even getting a major verdict, for example, doesn't make it go away. You remember Philander Castile, the brother that was shot and killed in Minneapolis on Facebook Live. The jury tried the officer. He was found not guilty. The city paid the family $6.5 million. So that's just the reality of the process. The officer usually are not prosecuted. But in this case, because there was a video, because there was protest, that works to pressure the prosecution to do the right thing.
Are you surprised that the point hasn't come where taxpayers get a little bit tired of paying for this stuff?
Brother, power concedes nothing voluntarily. So you gotta make it expensive for them to change. Typical example, man, is the chokehold in Los Angeles. In the 70s and the 80s, police had a technique where they'd put a brother in a choke and they would intend to press the carotid arteries on either side of the neck. And if they pressed the carotid arteries, the person was supposed to have his air stopped and he would pass out and not die. The LAPD was strangling brothers regularly with the chokehold. The chief of police, Daryl Gates, said, you know, it ain't the officers. Black people have something wrong with their necks. Wow. So that when they get choked, they tend to die. It's not our fault. I was in Johnny Cochran's office then, and the family of Charles Mincy, who was choked out and killed on the outskirts of L.A., we sued the city of L.A. We hit them for a big verdict, and there were others, and there were others. And because of the verdicts, the training changed. And I dare say right now, police officers no longer apply the chokehold. That training is off. A second example, positional asphyxiation. When the positioning of the body causes somebody to die, when you're big and overweight and your arms are in back of you, it compresses the stomach. And cops were putting big brothers on their face in the backseat of a police car with them handcuffed. And they were dying by positional asphyxiation. That's what happened to George Floyd it was on the neck. But they would handcuff you and put your face down in a car and you can't roll over and you're going to die. There were continual lawsuits. And sometimes we won and sometimes we lost. But now LAPD don't put fat brothers face down in the backseat of a police car, taking them into the station. That's the slow moving of progress, like an ocean liner, not like a speedboat.
So much of this is like, even for me as somebody who's fairly familiar with these things, it's just kind of mind blowing to consider. Like almost like the moment that you wonder when the cops realize, you know, if we put them on their stomachs and handcuff them, watch what happens.
Again, you got to understand, and I don't make excuse, it's dangerous. And cops are scared of brothers. It's dangerous. And white cops are scared of Latins. Some brothers are dangerous. Some Latins are dangerous. And every police officer has a story of an innocent domestic violence encounter that turns deadly. Every police officer has a story of a simple traffic stop that turns deadly. So that story dictates their mindset. Now, that's the police mentality generally. We have a larger problem here in Los Angeles and many other communities with the county sheriffs, a county of 10 million people. The county sheriffs take all of their recruits and put them first into the county jail, one of the largest penal institutions in America. So these new recruits, fresh off of the academy, are placed in the environment where 80% of the population are black and brown. And they have to talk with them in a certain way and exert a level of confidence in their voice called command presence that will get these gangbangers to move from spot one to spot B. And that mentality, they're there often for 3, 4, often 7 years in that environment. And they take that mindset and the training they have learned, and then they go out streets of Linwood or Compton or East LA, and they have that same mindset that they learned in the prison systems and take it out to the community. Is it any wonder there's no connection between white sheriff deputies and homies in the barrio? Is there any wonder there's no connection between a white sheriff deputy and the brothers in South Central at Nickerson Gardens? So these are some of the structural problems that creates the environment that we find ourselves, at least here in Los Angeles. There's a wider problem across America, man, because reform comes in the big cities first. Cincinnati has a reform-minded law enforcement. New York, with their history, has more reform-minded law enforcement. But it's going to take decades for that mindset to filter to the backwoods of Alabama or Missouri or Ohio or Georgia. You know about Georgia. 5 minutes outside of Georgia, back in the South, bruh. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
So it's going to take a while. It's going to take a lot more George Floyd's, regrettably.
Well, one thing I've thought about in this is one of the cruel ironies about the things that happen with cops is we got this thing, how do we make it stop? Well, the way they make everything stop otherwise is by throwing people in jail. And the hardest part about this is just even if you get it to trial is putting people in jail. Like, I'm curious with Floyd, how was the trial actually going to go? Because they went up to second degree murder. I've seen people say that they wanted to see a first degree murder charge. Like, whether it was legally sustainable or not, you'd never get a conviction on first degree murder. Like, I even worry a little bit about second, to be perfectly honest.
Yes. When you think about the entire history of Minnesota, there's only been one police officer ever convicted of an on-duty crime. And that was a black Somali officer.
Oh, a couple years ago.
Was shooting a white woman. That's the only time a police officer has ever been convicted of a crime. Bruh, I've been suing cops for 40 years. Johnny Cochran's office happened to get the creme de la creme of the cases where cops mistook some keys or a Bible or some cookies or that furtive gesture to the pants for a gun, and they shoot in the back, or they kill them. We got the best of all the cases in Johnny Cochran's office. I was there for 2.5 years, and I never saw a police officer convicted of a crime when there were officers that were ever tried, a la Rodney King. They were found not guilty, and the Rodney King experience blinded prosecutions across the entire country because prosecutions have to work in a symbiotic relationship with their law enforcement. There may be one police case, but 99.9% of the other times, the prosecution and the police are working hand to hand. And the most powerful local influencer in most communities is the police union. And because of the thirst for contributions from the police unions and the fear of incurring their wrath, that is the reason that more police officers are not prosecuted. And they point to Rodney King as the reason why they cannot convict even with a video.
Like, that is, to be fair, they have been reaffirmed that they cannot convict, right? Like, I see how they have reached that point. I just look at so many other people. Everybody else, they just decide to go throw people in jail, and they have shaken it.
I had a case where an old brother on a traffic stop chose to drive away before the cop was finished. No crime. Traffic stop. The cop pulls out his gun and fires 4 shots, strikes the guy in the back as he's driving away. That cop was prosecuted. But the city still made us go to trial. We had a deposition of the cop. He was sitting in prison blues. But the city still took that case to trial because they did not want to pay fair compensation to an old brother who got shot in the back. That's the mentality, because they'd rather have a runaway jury say that they gave him his money than hear the wrath of the city council with yet another police settlement demand.
Look, man, Carl Douglas, this has been incredible, man. Like, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. You echoed a lot of what we've talked about here is it's an optimism almost caused by darkness, right? That, like, I'm optimistic because it feels like the imaging that's now being shared and absorbed, it's gotten bad enough to reach people, which is not something you're happy about seeing, but it has reached people, you know?
There are collateral damages in every war, and we are in a war for justice. And you got to remember, last thing, man, for all your listeners, politicians remember two things that are important. One, do you give money? Or two, do you vote? With the pandemic, we ain't got much extra money. I get that. But at least we can do is vote.
Carl Douglas. My man, thank you so much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we will talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.